Hi, Coach. Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good.
Hey, no, it's good. Coach, just a couple, two-part questions real quick, unrelated. The first was, Bill, I was listening to you yesterday, and you commented about the, at first, congratulations, great effort, but Sunday, you commented that one of the things you were gonna, might be looking at during the bye week was execution on third and short, both offensively and defensively, and I was just wondering if that was a execution or schematic type of thing.
Yeah, we'll look at everything. Yeah, we got to look at everything. I'm sure that, I think we got to do a better job of coaching whatever it is we're doing, whether it's the plays or the techniques or whatever, and we just got to get everybody on the same page. It's obviously you don't need a lot of yardage there, but you need to be able to do it right, and a little bit of penetration or a little bit of being laid off the ball or not quite hitting the hole at the right angle or quick enough or whatever, and then you're stopped. So we just gotta look at the whole thing and try to. I mean, we gotta be able to convert better in that situation.
Bill, from your experience, what's produced the most successful bye week for you in terms of balancing, the first part of the season, cleaning stuff up, looking ahead to the rest of the season, and also, allowing players and coaches maybe to get away a little bit?
I don't know. Yeah, I think it's just a question of trying to utilize our time productively and get the most out of it. Part of it's rest, part of it's being able to get a little bit re-energized and just, give our minds a chance to not deal with a game plan, not deal with scouting report, not deal with adjustments, not get ready for a final exam. And at the same time, we need to try to look at some things that we can improve on and do better. And I think our team's made some improvements over the first 9 games of the season. And we need to keep doing that. So hopefully we can kind of strike that balance of improving in some areas and trying to maintain the consistency in some of the things that we've been fairly productive at.
And as a follow-up, Bill, what do you think has contributed to Patrick Chung's ability to come in and play at a level that seems to me to be maybe a little bit higher than we saw in his previous stop here, but I don't know if you would agree with that take.
I think he thought he played pretty well for us. In the time that he was here. I think kind of the circumstances of the 12 season just didn't work out, as well as probably we all hoped that they would, for a combination of reasons. And, Pat and I talked about that last year after he was released from Philadelphia. Pat and I talked about that. We had a long conversation about, a lot of things. And, I think not saying it was anybody's fault. It was just one of those things that didn't work out. But, we both felt that we'd want to try to give it another shot. And we were able to contractually. And I think he's done a real good job for us. He's filled a lot of different roles. He's played well. He's helped us in the kicking game. He's helped us defensively in a number of areas. He's been active, been around the ball, been productive. And he's got experience, so even though he's a new player, he was here for 4 years, so it's not, in a way, he really has a lot of experience in our system. So, but it's worked out really well, at least on my end of it. I feel great about having him on the team and what he's done for us.
Hey, Bill, I read last week that Denver had brought in a left-footed punter into camp, and they worked him out, and I don't know if that was as part of their preparation, but I'm curious about the history of left-footed punters with you in particular, and if there is an advantage to it. It seems like they've become more commonplace in the league in recent years, but I was wondering what was the thought process behind that originally, and whether or not there is a difference over the course of the season with having a left-footed punter.
Well, Bob, that's a good question. I think, you know, there's definitely something. I mean, you know, a left-footed punter and a right-footed punter, the ball spins opposite, and what you get used to when you go to the other foot, it's reversed. So, and I think there's definitely something to be said for that. Practicing that way, I know, you know, going back to when we were at the Giants and I was the special teams coach there, you know, we had a right-footed punter, obviously, with Jennings and then with Landetta. And when we would face a left-footed punter, we always kind of just wanted to get the returner to handle those balls, which is McConkey. Well, it was several different guys, but, you know, I definitely remember McConkey and, you know, how Phil would talk about how that would, you know, even though he'd done it before, it was just good to, you know, get familiar with it prior to doing it, you know, in the upcoming game. So Sims would punt to him. And even though Phil does a lot of things right-handed, he punts left-footed, believe it or not, and actually punts pretty well. So we would do that. You know, I had a lot of right-footed punters. I had Jennings, had Tom Tupa in Cleveland, Hansen. And then when I came here, you know, we had a left-footed punter, and we just with Johnson, and then it just was Walter and Miller, and it's just kind of evolved that way. Now we had Sauerbrunn for a while, you know, half a season or a quarter, third of a season, whatever it was. But for the most part, it's been left-footed punters since I've been here in New England, and that's not really by design. I'd say it's just more kind of work out that way. But it is kind of a long coincidence of that, but it was probably just as much of a coincidence that it was the other way. So I don't think it really makes any difference in terms of, you know, the punting, because there's nobody else involved. I mean, you know, the snapper and then the punter. It's not like you have a left-footed kicker where you have to, you know, flip your holder, and the operation is a little bit backwards with the punter. It's just, you know, the way he does it, and it doesn't really affect anybody else. But I think there is something to the returner. Getting familiar with those balls. I don't think it's, I mean, I don't want to make a big deal out of it, because I don't think it's that big of a deal, but I do think that there's no question it's the reverse spin and you know, the kind of the reverse reading of the ball.
Hi, Bill. I'm just wondering how much of this extra time that you guys have here will be spent looking ahead and preparing a little bit for some of these teams that maybe you're not as familiar with, these AFC or those NFC North teams that are coming up on the schedule.
Right.
Or is it, yeah. Or is it, you know, primarily just looking at the Colts?
Right. Well, Phil, we have on our staff, we have certain people on our staff that it's kind of their job to get ahead. And so, if we're playing game one, then there's certain coaches that are working on games two and three and so forth and bump it right on down the line. And so once we're finished with game one and we turn to game two, I would say the majority of the staff and even a couple coaches that might look a little bit ahead, they'd probably put 90 to 95% of their time in on the team that we're actually playing. So, but there's still a process of organizationally working ahead so that when the coaches go and the other coaches go and turn their attention to the next opponent, that the information's there, it's already been identified, sorted out, and, you know, there's a presentation of it that, you know, cuts and identifies a lot of the details, so you don't have to wade through it and, you know, everybody try to figure it out themselves. So I don't think that's really going to, you know, change too much, to be honest with you. I think this week is, you know, about looking at some of the things that we need to do. It's looking a bit for the Colts, but then again, there are people on the staff and in the organization that are beyond that in terms of preparing us for those teams when we get to them. And so it's really always that way. So we'll continue to probably stay with that same pattern, if that makes any sense.
Bill, I have a question for you. It's a historical one, and I'm going to preface it by saying you were still in prep school at the time for the era I want to talk about, but I didn't know if your studies in the history of the game might be able to help here, but I was curious what it would have been like, the challenges, and just in general, what it was like for Gino Cappelletti to kick field goals back in the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for not dating me back quite that far. But when I first came into the league in 1975, like we talked about this before, but I think I would say most teams had a kicker. Some teams had a punter. Other teams had a guy that played a position and also punted. And then most every team had a position player who was the long snapper, either an offensive lineman or a linebacker or a tight end or, you know, somebody like that. And there were very few just pure long snappers like every team has now. And there were, as I said, some punters. There were more punters than there were position players punting, but there was, you know, an element of both. And I'd say the kickers had almost all transitioned at that point. So, you know, I think one of the big things with kicking, unlike punting, is timing. You have the snapper and the holder and the operation and when the kicker, you know, starts a little bit early, then that fouls up the timing. And if the kicker starts a little bit late, then it doesn't foul up the timing. It just puts you at more at risk to have the kick blocked. And so, you know, one of the things the kicker deals with is just the timing, and some of that's the anticipation. So the more the kicker knows the snapper, the more he can kind of anticipate that mannerism or, you know, length of time, anticipation of when the snap's going to occur, and then start into his approach to the ball and kick. So, you know, obviously the better that operation is and the more experience those guys have together, to include the holder, then, you know, theoretically the better it'll be, the smoother it'll be. With a punter, again, there's less of that. I mean, there's some, but there's certainly less of that because that other guy's not involved. So, again, this is a long answer to a short question. But, again, part of the issue in the kicking game in those days was time. So if you were a kicker, you weren't able to kick until, even if that's all you did, if you were just a pure kicker, then you wouldn't be able to kick until the center was available to snap. So, you know, the centers would usually come out, you know, maybe, you know, 5-10 minutes early and, you know, maybe say snap for the punter, and the punters would punt to the punt returners, which, again, your punt returners were usually position players too. And then let's call it after practice, then that same snapper would snap to the holder and the kicker, and that was their practice. You know, those, whatever it was, 5-10 minutes at the end of practice, and the same thing with their turners. You know, now you have situations where during the whole practice, you know, as you've seen out there on the field, the snapper, the holder, and the kicker, or the snapper and the punter work together for extended periods of time. It's not just, you know, 5 minutes at the end of practice after everything else has been done. So the opportunity to be, you know, precise and efficient in the execution level on that is, you know, obviously drastically improves. And I'd say then where you see the where I've seen the biggest change. So was it challenging for those kickers? Yeah, sure it was, because, you know, A, the field conditions were a lot less than what they are now, you know, where it's either great, most fields are pretty good grass, or it's turf, which is very consistent. I mean, you know, back in those days you had the fields would vary from, you know, one end to the other, depending on if you were kicking sometimes on the, you know, the infield end that was sodded or not sodded, depending on what time of year it was, versus the outfield end in the baseball stadiums, which is what most of them were. So the conditions weren't as good, the timing wasn't as good, the opportunity to work with those players with each other wasn't as good. And then, you know, I would say that the biggest difference would be in the punting game, when I would say, you know, until the mid-80s, you know, most all teams used at least one end tight, if not both ends tight in punt formation, unless they could see that the team was in an obvious return mode and there wasn't a threat to rush, then, you know, they would split out both guys. But a lot of times you'd see guys split out, and then if the return team threatened, then they'd pull them in, and there were tight punt formations. And so in the mid-80s, really the whole punting game, I would say, kind of got revolutionized and changed dramatically with, you know, with Steve DiAssi in Dallas. And when Steve went to Dallas, he was able to snap and block, and Dallas went, you know, exclusively to a spread punt formation. And, you know, teams like, you know, us, the Giants, because they were in our division, you know, we you know, always felt like, I mean, normally the snapper's responsibility on the punt formation back in those days was just snap the ball. They didn't have any blocking responsibility ever. And then that all changed when DiAssi went to Dallas and he started doing it. And so, you know, you'd see what you see now, which is two spread guys. Eight guys rush, the center will block one of them, and the other seven guys block the other seven, and they punted the ball. And once we all saw that it was doable and Steve was doing it, then you started looking for, okay, well, can we get a guy to do that? And then that enabled you to split the ends out. And so that's not a kicking conversation, but it's all kind of related there, that then that, you know, got to the evolution of how important the snapper was. And I would say that teams at that point saw the value of keeping a pure snapper that was able to not only snap the ball consistently, but also snap and block, because of the advantages that it gave you in the punting game. And then, you know, I'd say within probably 5 years or so, by the early 90s, you know, you rarely saw a team in a tight punt formation unless, you know, it was the end of the game or backed up or, you know, a situational type of punt. Then almost everybody went to, you know, spread punt formations. And that was really the result of the snapping situation, in my opinion.
Bill, another special teams question. What are some of the measures you use to try and determine how effective your special teams are? I'm guessing yards gained or saved by plays in the punting game and things like that. I'm just curious. I was reading a book last night that mentioned actually Phil McConkie, who you mentioned earlier in the call, having saved about 113 yards worth of field position in a playoff game that the Giants played. Are those measures you guys keep?
Yeah, sure. I think that's absolutely, you know, really comes under the whole category of, you know, hidden yardage, if you will. You know, for example, fielding a punt and fair, or catching a punt or fair catching a punt that's, say, 37 yards versus not catching it and it, you know, rolls another 13 yards and now it's a 50-yard net, or, you know, 13-yard change of field position. So those 13 yards don't show up in the stats. You know, it's not a sack. It's not a, you know, it's just if you had handled the ball, you would have had it at, you know, midfield, but you didn't handle it, so you have it at your 37. And, you know, those plays are definitely hidden yardage in the kicking game. Things like penalties that, you know, not only, you know, I mean, they're generally at the spot of where the ball was caught most of the time in the punting game. So if you, you know, return a punt for 10 yards and get a, you know, a penalty, you know, it's really a 20-yard loss of field position as opposed to a 10-yard penalty. So the penalties in the kicking game, generally speaking, you know, result in more yardage than they do on normal scrimmage plays. So
I think he had one the other night.
Yes. Right.
Yep.
So
how have you guys done, right. I guess? And I don't want to. How have you guys done this?
So that kind of, right, that was a good example right there of that when they, Don Jones got the block in the back call. So they lost the return yardage and then they had the penalty on top of it. So it, you know, ended up being a, you know, I don't know, 20% of the field, 25% of the field, you know. So, I mean, it was a huge field position play penalty. So, I mean, we track all those. We try to obviously stress the importance to the players of those, you know, decisions and those situations because of, you know, what's at stake there from a field position standpoint. So, you know, I mean, another huge stat in the kicking game is missed field goals. I mean, really, missed field goals are almost the equivalent to a turnover.
Mm-hmm.
Not only do you get the ball, but you get it, you know, plus 7 yards. So, you know, there's a real cost to, you know, a missed field goal in terms of field position, particularly on a longer one, obviously. But, you know, if you miss it from the 15, then, you know, it's not that much different than if, you know, you had punted. But, if you know, you miss a, you know what I mean? So you miss a long field goal, like that's, you know, that's really like a turnover. So
Yeah. There's
a lot of hidden yardage there. There's a lot of different ways to, you know, calculate it and measure it and all that. But, I mean, the bottom line is, as a coach, I mean, what you want your team to do is, you know, make the most out of each situation. And, you know, like we saw a play in our game where, you know, we mishandled a kickoff in the end zone, but the ball didn't come out of the end zone, so we downed it. We saw a play the other night, similar play where the ball did roll out of the end zone. You know, things like that, which, again, it's not really a stat play. It is, but it isn't. But it's certainly a big field position play. So, like I said, the goal for us as a coaching staff is to try to get the most out of those plays, like whatever it is. So, you know, do we measure it? I mean, yeah, we do. But the most important thing is to try to make sure that we do it right and get the most out of it. And when we don't, then we need to make sure that, you know, the players understand, and we all understand, you know, how important those plays are.
Thanks a lot.
Last question.
Bill, I was just wondering, did you have any connections with Brendan Daly before bringing him in this year? And, you know, how has he fit in just with the players and staff in his first go-around with the Pats?
Yeah, I mean, I have had some connections with Brendan. Of course, Brendan has coached with other members of our coaching staff at other places. And some of the other people that Brendan has worked with, you know, I've worked with and known through the years and so forth. So, you know, I haven't obviously worked with him. I haven't had a personal relationship with him until this year, but I'd say we've both kind of known about each other through mutual friends and associates and that kind of thing. I think he's done a great job for us. You know, he's obviously has, you know, a lot of experience. It's experience in different organizations, which I think is, you know, can be a strength because it just, you know, brings a different perspective. I think his fundamental teaching background on the defensive line is outstanding. I think he really has a great understanding of technique, hand placement, and, you know, fundamental teaching. I would say that, you know, the way he does it is exactly the way I learned it and we taught it at the Giants. You know, may not be the exact same terminology, but it's the same technique. It's the same points of emphasis. I think he's, you know, brought a lot of drill work and some of the coaching points that he uses. You know, I've learned a lot of those, and you know, the way he kind of puts it, or the way he sets up the drill, or the way he teaches it. You know, I look at it and say, you know, I wish we had done it that way. You know, I really like the way he does that, or really think that's a good way to teach it, or that's a good progression to teach it in for, you know, a younger player, a guy that's learning it. So that's, you know, kind of the, you know, the background on him. A lot of a very good fundamental coach, a lot of great experience doing that, teaches very well, works very well with all the players, the experienced guys as well as the guys with less experience, you know, brings a perspective to our staff that's, you know, a little bit different. I mean, it isn't like he's, you know, spent all his time here. But I don't think that's a bad thing at all. I think in a way it's, in this case, it's a really good thing. He's sharp. He works hard. He's great to work with. So glad he's on our staff. I think he's done a real good job for us.